This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Talk about a tangled web. The President of the United States ordered unprecedented domestic spying on Americans without warrants to meet what was seen as a terrible threat. Many believe that act was illegal, even unconstitutional, but it was classified, and someone leaked it to the New York Times. Now, the President's Department of Justice is investigating that leak, looking for a leaker or a whistleblower, depending how you see it. It could mean leakers and reporters in jail and a free press on trial, even as the White House itself is called on the carpet for potential lawbreaking. Up next on Point, a criminal probe to punish exposure of domestic spying and the high-stakes standoff in Washington. Joining me now from Washington is Josh Meyer, national security correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. Josh, thanks very much for being with us.
You're very welcome.
Bring us up to date first, if you would, on the investigation in the Senate. Have they moved ahead? Have they announced anything on their investigation into the president's action with this domestic spying?
Well, Senator Schumer promises to hold hearings on this. The Judiciary Committee with Arlen Specter is planning to hold hearings on this. There have not been dates set yet for that, and I suspect there's going to be some foot dragging on the part of the White House. But they're gearing up for early January to hold hearings on that, and of course the Justice Department probe is moving right along.
So very soon we may have both of these things underway at once, a Senate hearing into whether the President's program was legal, whether it was constitutional, and at the same time the Justice Department inquiry. Exactly how was that launched, by whom, Josh, and where is it aimed?
Well, those are very good questions, and we're still trying to answer them. This broke late last week, of course, and it seemed like journalists were the only ones in town at least willing to answer the phone. And we were really not having much luck getting answers from people. For instance, traditionally such investigations are started by the host agency, for instance, in this case the National Security Agency. If it was their information that was quote-unquote leaked, then they would ask for the investigation and the Justice Department would do it. But that the DOJ rarely unilaterally started an investigation. But in this case, we're not really sure who asked for it. Folks at Justice suggest that, at least to me, that it was requested from somebody outside. But Trent Duffy, the White House spokesperson on Friday, said that the Justice Department initiated it themselves.
Now, Alberto Gonzalez is, of course, currently U.S. Attorney General at the head of the Department of Justice, but he was White House counsel when President Bush signed the executive order authorizing this NSA program. Will Gonzalez be recused from involvement in this investigation?
Well, this is bringing up a lot of the same questions that the Valerie Plame investigation brought up before, and I remember being in the room when John Ashcroft suddenly, at a news conference, surprisingly said he was recusing himself from that and stepping out of the way because of what seemed to be far, far less significant connections to the president than Attorney General Gonzalez has. So we'll have to wait and see. But Gonzalez, yes, was his legal counsel. And then before that in Texas when Bush was governor, Gonzalez was his legal counsel there too, as well as a Bush appointee to the state Supreme Court.
So we heard President Bush there saying this is a leak and a shame and an outrage, and he urged the Department of Justice to look into it publicly, as I recall. Senator Schumer and others saying, wait a minute, where exactly is the wrongdoing here? What will an investigation look like, Josh? Who is likely to be caught up in this process?
Well, I mean, the one thing that we do know for sure is that the White House did not ask for this investigation, according to Duffy and some others speaking for the president Friday. I wrote a story over the weekend trying to figure all of that out and said that the investigation is likely to reach into some high echelons of the U.S. government. I mean, because of this very nature of the program being as classified and top secret as it was, you know, you're hearing everybody now say, hey, I didn't even know about this. I mean, some extremely high-level people had not been told about it, including apparently the Deputy Attorney General under Ashcroft, his first deputy, Larry Thompson. And so if that's true, then few people knew about it, and few of them, you know, the pool of people that could have known about it and could have leaked information, for instance, or disclosed it or whistleblowed, however you want to describe it, mm-hmm. is fairly high, small, and it's fairly high-level people.
Now, we have two New York Times reporters here, Eric Lichtblau and James Risen. Are we likely to see a repeat of the Valerie Plame, Judy Miller case? Are they likely or possibly going to end up in jail as leverage for them to say who told them what?
Well, I hate to speculate on that part of this, just because, you know, nobody knows what's going to happen. The climate against journalists is not a very good one right now. I know both of those guys personally, and they're excellent reporters and certainly very ethical. Both of them used to work at the LA Times with me.
Mm-hmm.
I am sure that they and their lawyers and their editors discussed all of this very, very carefully before going to press with it.
Josh Meyer, thanks very much for the update today.
You're
we appreciate
welcome.
It. Josh Meyer, national security correspondent for the L.A. Times. He joined us from Washington. Joining me now from Berkeley, California, is Orville Schell. He is dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at the University of California, Berkeley. Dean Schell, thanks for being with us.
Pleasure.
The implications for a free press of this inquiry?
Well, clearly, the press is having a bad patch here in terms of its relationship to the government. And I think in some important ways, the tension derives from two very different notions of the press. Those of us who are reporters and journalists imagine ourselves as independent. We imagine ourselves, I think, in the sort of tradition of the founding fathers, namely that we are an extra-governmental check and balance mm-hmm. against government power. But I think on the other side, there is a long tradition that began really back in the Nixon era that views the press as less august in its role as a legitimate critic of government and confuses in many ways the role assigned to the media with the role assigned to public relations. And as you recall, that President Nixon was really the first person to bring public relations specialists into the government. Now, that's a very different can of worms. Public relations is basically propaganda. It doesn't esteem the independent voice of somebody in communications, but a voice is the megaphone for the state, the party, the corporation. And I think that really is the fundamental conflict, which we see being acted out, two very different notions that the role the press should play.
Can a free press live with whistleblowers being framed as criminal leakers?
Well, as you know, this is just the another in a long series of cases where anonymous sources and whistleblowers have run into trouble, and there is no federal shield law protecting them.
We've been joined in this hour by Orville Schell, dean and professor at the Graduate School of Journalism at the University of California at Berkeley. We're joined right now from Washington by Victoria Tensing, former Deputy Assistant General Attorney General in the U.S. Department of Justice's Terrorism Unit from 84 to 88. She's a founding partner of DeGeneva and Tensing. Victoria Tensing, thanks very much for being with us.
Hello.
How do you see what's going on here? The questions about the spying program itself. Now we have an investigation into the leak that brought it into the public view. Right? Wrong? Who's in the light? Who's in the dark here?
Let me make two points off the bat, but this area is so rich with issues, and
mm-hmm.
we could go on for several hours
mm-hmm.
here. First, you either have laws, the government either has laws against exposing, publishing, revealing classified information, or it doesn't. So if those laws are in place, then the government it has a responsibility to pursue them, not in every single case, but in important matters.
What if it's illegal activity that's been classified?
First of all, nobody knows that, and that actually just brought me to my second point,
mm-hmm.
which is I'm just amazed at listening that we assume that the person who revealed this information was, quote-unquote, a whistleblower. And the press, just the opposite, in not treating everyone the same, when Bob Novak printed a column,
mm-hmm.
and everyone knows Bob's a curmudgeon, and
yep,
doesn't
yep.
stick up for the administration, anyone who knows him. And he was exposing how stupid the CIA was to send someone on an important mission at the request of his suggestion of his wife, and the person wasn't qualified. Nobody said, well, that was exposing nepotism and wrongdoing. And yet, that's as likely an explanation as here you could also have an explanation, since it was first revealed, according to the New York Times a year ago, that someone did it to try to affect the election.
But maybe
we're jumping to conclusions here.
Yeah, but maybe a different scale. I mean, you are quite right. We cannot presume leaker or whistleblower, but you really have to ask both questions when this question of illegality, even unconstitutionality, still swirls around President Bush's domestic spying program.
No, it isn't domestic, and for you to characterize that way tells, you know, something is like calling somebody anti-choice.
Well, it is domestic because the spying includes activity. Yes,
and it's during
both.
A war, and so the case law has looked quite differently at that rather than the totally domestic spying that went on that has been referred to a lot by talking heads during the Nixon era. The courts, all the courts that have heard the issue, including the FISA court, have said that they accept that the president has inherent constitutional authority beyond FISA, the court that we're talking about.
We've heard, of course, that interpretation widely challenged since the news came out. What about the Times publishing this story, Ms. Tenzing? Do you think they were right in doing that, Free Press? Is this the new Pentagon Papers brought to light, or is this a shameful breach of national security, as the president would have it?
Well, I think it's a shameful breach of national security, but I would not be for pursuing them criminally. I would be for pursuing who the person is that gave them the information.
Do you expect to see these Times reporters, one or both, in jail, a la Judy Miller, to put pressure on them to say who leaked the information?
Well, here's how it may be different from the Valerie Plame. In the Valerie Plame, everybody that we know about, anybody who was an important witness, waived their confidentiality. I doubt if that's going to be done here. I mean, the people who were in the government, all the people who were, you know, talking to the press about anything said, okay, you can go ahead and talk about it. That probably will not be done here. Where was all this editorial opinion and concern when Bob Novak's column was being investigated? In fact, it was just the opposite. I know I did research on all the editorials. Not only were, like the Atlantic Constitution called it close to treason, and a columnist for the New York Times said that Bob Novak should be criminally prosecuted.
Do you really equate him on Valerie Plame with this sort of very large scale phone tapping exercise?
Oh, not at all. I think Bob Novak's revelation was, by comparison, unimportant because to this date, and I started saying this to people over a year ago, there was no crime committed. Nobody has said that she was sufficiently covered by the Identities Protection Act. But here, this is a breach of national security.
Victoria Tenzing, if a leaker is found out in this investigation and goes before a court, there's a criminal trial, what kind of penalties might they be facing?
I believe it's up to 10 years.
Mm-hmm. So this is serious.
But see
serious
how
business.
Many counts and all of that, and whether they're consecutive. Or
if you stand by for just a moment, Victoria Tenzing, Orville Schell, I want to welcome into our conversation from Chicago Jeffrey Stone. He's a professor of law at the University of Chicago, author of Perilous Times: Free Speech in Wartime, from the Sedition Act of 1798 to the War on Terrorism. Jeffrey Stone, thanks very much for being with us.
Delighted to be here.
What do you see going on in this welter of charge and countercharge here? The president's program is illegal. The leaking was illegal. What's on the line here, Professor Stone?
Well, as Victoria said, there's a wealth of issues here. The first issue, of course, is whether the program itself was unlawful or unconstitutional. If it was a lawful and constitutional program, and if one assumes, as I would, that the government ordinarily has a right to maintain confidentiality of lawful programs that are important to the national security, then those individuals who disclose the information are in real trouble. On the other hand, if, as I believe, this program is both unlawful and unconstitutional, then the government, whether or not there's a law prohibiting the leaking, has no legitimate constitutional right to protect the confidentiality of wrongdoing on its own part, in which case the individuals who disclose the information will not be subject to any penalties. So the predicate issue, in some sense, has to be whether the programs themselves were lawful. Beyond that, there's the question, of course, of how one determines that, at what time in the process that gets determined.
Yes.
and what the leakers themselves actually believed at the time that they disclosed the information about the legality of the programs. And part of the difficulty we have in enforcing these sorts of laws is that there is no very good process in place to determine whether the classification of government information is itself lawful.
Well, if I may ask you, what about that? The Department of Justice now has an inquiry up on the rails. It's proceeding, we're told, around the issue of the potential illegality of the leak. Now, about the issue of the legality, the constitutionality of the program itself, we have a Senate inquiry promised, but who knows exactly when and with what impact? So is there equity in the vigor of these two investigations?
Well, the Senate or congressional investigation is important and interesting for the future of public policy, but it cannot determine for purposes of a prosecution whether or not the programs were lawful or the leaks were criminal. Those determinations ultimately will have to be made by courts of law. And the way that is likely to happen is that as long as the government maintains its position that the program was both lawful and constitutional, it is going to proceed with the investigation to determine who disclosed the information. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, those issues will be decided by courts. Now, in terms of the confidentiality of the sources from the standpoint of the New York Times reporters, mm-hmm. As we've already seen in the Valerie Plame incident, there is no federal statute that creates a shield for these types of circumstances, and whatever protection the First Amendment has been held to give in these circumstances is relatively limited. Therefore, if the government does decide to subpoena the New York Times reporters and ask them to name their sources, we will have essentially a replay of the Judy Miller situation. Now, they may decide, the reporters that is, that if the court concludes that the programs were themselves unlawful, if the court concludes that the programs themselves were lawful,
the NSA surveillance,
the NSA programs, mm-hmm. right? Then they may conclude, as indeed I believe they should in that circumstance, as I believe that Judith Miller should have, that their only appropriate response is to comply with the law. But that's a long way from here. That requires the investigation to continue, the government to continue to assert its erroneous view that these programs by the NSA were lawful, a court ultimately to find that they were lawful, and ultimately that could take another year before we get to the point of a judicial determination as to whether or not the reporters have to disclose their sources.
Orville Schell, let me ask you, what do you see at stake here for the investigative range of the country's free press?
Well, if indeed it turns out that these wiretaps that the National Security Agency launched are legal, then I think reporters are going to be in great jeopardy. I think the question that I would ask as a reporter is if it is illegal to write a story based on an anonymous source on a subject like this, what is legal? In other words, is there anything you can write about that comes from a source within the government that hasn't been completely vetted and approved of by the government?
But, of course, it's not the publishing that's been challenged so far. It's simply been the act of leaking. But that flow of information from the government out is what feeds a free press, I guess.
Well, absolutely. If you don't have a source, you don't have a story. And I would have to say, as somebody who spent most of my adult life in and around China and looking at the way the media works in China, you do appreciate in a very deep way the necessity of protecting journalists, of protecting their right to seek out and to get information about government malfeasance.
Victoria Tensing in Washington, let me put this to you. We understand very clearly your view on this, that the president was within the law, was within the Constitution with the surveillance program that he put forward. But let me ask you, if someone in government, and we see this as open to interpretation, you can hear that right here in this conversation, if someone inside government believed this was not legal but understood it was classified, at what point is it incumbent on them to go ahead and leak anyway, even if it's technically classified, if they believe it's illegal? Or what should they do?
First of all, the law does not have an exception for a higher cause defense. any more than it does in the abortion clinic bombings, when the people who bombed clinics said, well, we didn't believe that that was right, you're killing people, you're murderers, and so we bombed the building. And the law clearly said that's not appropriate. That's not an appropriate defense.
Nevertheless, we all understand the just following orders trap here. If the person believed
it
was illegal.
The law doesn't. Mm-hmm. Doesn't have that provision in
right.
it. I actually, Jeffrey is recommending the procedure that I thought that the newspaper should have taken in the Valerie Plame case, which was to have had a hearing before the trial judge to determine that the Agent Identities Act had been violated prior to even going, putting these journalists in jeopardy. For some reason, they did not do that.
And so in the NSA case, what does that suggest?
Well, I don't have a problem with a pretrial motion. If I were representing the reporters, I'd bring a pretrial motion, that said this was an illegal procedure and let the court decide. I still don't think that's going to have any effect whatsoever.
And what if the leaker or whistleblower, depending on your view, believed that this was illegal, believed it was unconstitutional?
There's a procedure for that. It's a good question, and people who aren't familiar with the law. There's a specific provision in the law probably the basic law that's being looked at, 18 U.S.C. 798,
mm-hmm.
and it says nothing in this section shall prohibit furnishing information to the appropriate committees in Congress, and that's where these people should have gone.
Jeffrey Stone, what about it? They should have gone to Congress, not to the New York Times.
Well, I agree with Victoria that as a general matter, if an individual violates a law, it doesn't matter whether it's the law we're talking about here about leaks or whether it's a law about where you can have demonstrations or a law about incitement to riot,
mm-hmm.
If you violate a law and it turns out that the law was constitutional as applied to you, you can be punished regardless of whether you believed the law to be unlawful. On the other hand, if the law is unconstitutional as applied to you, then you may not be punished. And that's really the issue that's presented here. If these whistleblowers or leakers disclosed information about an unlawful program, they will not be punishable. If they disclosed information about a lawful program, that could lawfully be kept secret because of the significance
right.
of the national security information, then they can be punished regardless of the fact that they may have had good motives, because the motives are not really relevant ultimately to the determination of their criminal liability.
So all this hinging on exactly what was legal on both sides of this equation. Victoria Tensing, former Deputy Attorney General in the U.S. Department of Justice's Terrorism Unit from 84 to 88. Thanks very much for being with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Justice Department's investigation of leaks about President Bush's domestic spying program, about the press and the exposure of potential executive wrongdoing that is classified in a time of security threats. We're joined from New York by James Goodale, a former vice chairman and general counsel of the New York Times from 1959 to 80. He was general counsel of the Times during the Pentagon Papers case. Mr. Goodale, thanks for being with us.
Hello, you're welcome.
How do you see what's going on in this whole case, Mr. Goodale?
Well, the New York Times should publish all the information it has its hands on, unless in the rare circumstances it's illegal, and it's very, very rare. There was nothing illegal about this publication. The publication was in the public interest. The issues at stake can be solved easily by the president going to the FISA court and getting approval 72 hours later after he's done it. And if, in fact, we need to tap in the United States by a particular agency, the FBI is a perfectly good agency to go ahead and tap, and they didn't use the FBI here. It's a clear violation of the law.
So in this investigation now of what's being described as a leak, what do you see at stake for the press, for the Times?
Well, ultimately, as the previous speakers have pointed out, there may be a court test. Frankly, I would welcome the court test, because I think that if the press can't report a leak like this, it really shouldn't be able to report anything. And what will happen is, first of all, I think there may be a good chance the press would win this one, even though it's back in the same court where Julie Miller lost. And even if it doesn't, which I don't think is going to happen, it will certainly create a lot of energy for a shield law.
And you're saying that what they might win, what's at issue is not whether or not they could publish this, but whether they could shield their sources.
Yes, that's what would happen, as the previous speakers have said. The reporters, Mr. Risen, would be asked to divulge his source. He would refuse to, and there would be a court test. But we have a different kind of a court test here, don't we, than the Miller case, which didn't involve this kind of whistleblowing. And the courts may look on this kind of case, particularly with a different cast.
You were there for the Pentagon Papers. You lived with many of us through Watergate. On what scale do you see this current standoff? Is it on a par, on a scale with those?
Well, if indeed the government is so foolish to go after the press in this case, it'll be right up there. It'll be right up there with Watergate. It'll be right up there with the great reporters' privilege cases. But, you know, the government may not do that. The government certainly has a right to investigate its leaks or whistleblowers, depending on how you want to do it, and it may just stop there.
It could.
Yeah, I'd like to, as long as I've got the mic here, just for a sec, you know, I think the government's off on the wrong track here. This is a clear violation of the law. If you look at the law, it's clear that the law has been violated.
Now, which are you speaking of, the leak or the NSA program?
NSA program.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly a violation of the law, as your previous earlier speaker said, called in. But the Attorney General has a responsibility to enforce the laws of this country, the last I've heard. He ought to be looking at whether the president has committed a crime and whether his colleagues have aided and abetted that crime. I don't understand why no one has said that. It's clear to me.
There's the opposite view from the former general counsel of the New York Times, James Goodale. Mr. Goodale, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
Jeffrey Stone, I wonder what you make of the Times' long wait to put this story out there. If this was free game in December of 2005, why not in December or November or October of 2004?
Well, first I want to underscore my agreement with what Jim Goodale said, because I think it's very important not to lose sight of the fact that these programs were, that is, the NSA programs authorized by the president and by Attorney General Gonzalez, were unlawful and unconstitutional. And your caller Robert was right to say that it's essential to keep our eye on that ball. This is a travesty of abuse of government power, and ultimately will be and must be condemned both by the Congress and by the courts. Now, having said that, to come back to the New York Times, it's a mystery to me. I mean, I would love to know what explanation exists within the Times, other than the fact that they did have the awkwardness of juggling the Judith Miller case at the same time that this was going on, and that apparently the administration made a very strong plea to the Times to maintain the confidentiality of the information. But I have to say that I've not yet heard any good explanation from the Times as to why they would not have disclosed this information.
Orville Schell, what about it, that long wait by the Times? If they thought it was somehow wrong to publish in 2004, what makes it right in 2005?
Well, it is a bit mysterious. Bill Keller, the editor of the New York Times, spoke of holding it a year, which is a fairly sort of flexible notion.
Yes.
And the question that one immediately wants to pose is, was it, did they have this information in the article prepared before the election? And were they deterred by fears that they would seem prejudiced if they dropped a bomb in the last days of the campaign? That's a possibility. I think another possibility is that they published a year later with some amendments to satisfy what they thought were the legitimate White House concerns.
Because they have also said that there are still facts that they have omitted from their published report. Jeffrey Stone, where do you actually see this heading? You've got the kind of alacrity with which the Department of Justice can move, the sort of lumbering process of Congress, suggestion earlier that a court could look into the NSA program, but how and when might that happen?
Well, the Congress will look into this, obviously, and it will, in all likelihood, wind up before the courts through the investigation, the potential subpoenaing of reporters, and ultimately the potential criminal prosecution of leakers. Also, there are individuals who have been prosecuted who have been prosecuted on the basis of information that apparently was obtained in these various wiretaps, and their lawyers are now raising quite legitimately the question as to whether their prosecutions or convictions were unconstitutional. So these issues are absolutely going to get fleshed out in the Congress and the public, obviously, and in the courts. I do believe it will be found that these programs are unlawful and unconstitutional, but I think it's going to be a really interesting test of partisanship in this nation. It is likely the case that many Republicans will see this matter from a perspective that is sympathetic to the administration, but sincerely, as well as from a standpoint of partisanship, and that this will hinge in a situation in which both houses of Congress are dominated by the same party as the president, on the ability and willingness of some of those individuals to fulfill their oaths of office and to look at it with a clear-eyed way about the demands of the law and the Constitution to be willing to call a spade a spade. And I believe they will. I think that's what will happen.
Let me ask you just a concrete question. Are you suggesting that the Justice Department investigation of the leaks may it be turned and become a kind of trial of the NSA program itself? Could it really extend to encompass the legality or illegality of the NSA program? Won't that be beyond its purview?
No, it'll inevitably be reached if the investigation continues, because the only way that the whistleblowers could be prosecuted would be if it is determined that the information that they leaked did not constitute disclosure of unconstitutional or unlawful government activity. So quite clearly, the defense of the individuals, if they are ever prosecuted, will be that they were, in fact, whistleblowers, not leakers. Mm. Therefore, their rights under the First Amendment are violated by the prosecution. And so it's inescapable that before anyone can be convicted of these disclosures, a court will have to find whether or not those disclosures are lawful.
Orville Schell, finally to you. We've just got a minute here. Do you see the press, with the New York Times publication of this, exercising vigor, or the press under the gun? What on balance, how do you see the press standing in all this?
Well, I think the press is beginning to arch its back a bit since the days of weapons of mass destruction and Judy Miller's reporting that turned out to be so erroneous. But I do very much fear that this is a government that does not respect the role of the press in our society, in our system of governance, and in every way possible seeks to marginalize it. This is not a good thing for the country. It's not a good thing for democracy.
Well, we're very grateful to both of you for being with us in this hour. Orville Schell, Dean and Professor at the Graduate School of Journalism at the University of California at Berkeley, thanks very much for joining us. And Jeffrey Stone, Professor of Law at the University of Chicago, author of Perilous Times. Professor Stone, thank you for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.